This episode is brought to you by Miracle Made. Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center left to center right, and I'm guest host A.B. Stoddard of the Bulwark, sitting in for Mona Charon today. Joining me are Damon Linker, who publishes Substack Notes from the Middle Ground, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, and our special guest today is Philip Bump of the Washington Post. Guys, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been the most amazing, I think, really starting around the first week of February, crush of consequential news that will not only shape the 2024 race, but I think the country for years to come. We're not going to have Donald Trump going to trial beyond his porn star hush money case at the end of March. I don't really know what that's going to do, but everyone who was hoping that they would, on the Republican side, impeach Joe Biden, it doesn't look like that'll happen. On the Democratic side, see a conviction for Donald Trump. But we are at the dreaded general election with the two people that we knew would be the nominees and that the American public just doesn't want to choose from. So I want to focus on what the race is going to look like. And we all know that since you last met, there was just horrible polling out of the New York Times over the weekend, the New York Times Siena poll for Joe Biden. But it was completely consistent with all of the polling that we've seen for these general election matchups. So no, they weren't officially in control of delegates and nominees in waiting. But now we're looking at this race for real. And those numbers, again, every trend line is the same. So I want to open with you, Bill. You just wrote about this. Biden's coalition that he put together in 2020 and that the Democrats hope have held together in the 2022 midterms and all these special elections is really weakening. A dramatic swing, you wrote, of 6.6 points nationally from his win to where he is in polling now. But then some of the stretches, some of the swings are far worse with key subgroups. Talk about what's happened to the Biden voting electorate.
One adjective to apply to the coalition is fraying, but there are parts of it that seem to be collapsing altogether. On the fraying side, and this is really hard to believe, His reported support among African Americans is down to 66%, and 23% of African Americans say they're going to vote for Donald Trump. That would be an earthquake if it happened. And I'm not saying it's going to happen. We're just looking at snapshots, but the snapshots are disturbing. His margin among young voters ages 18 to 29 down double digits. And astonishingly, the New York Times found that Donald Trump is actually leading Joe Biden among Hispanics by 6 percentage points. I'm trying to find a noun to describe that outcome if it came to pass. And I have a pretty good internal thesaurus, but I can't find one. And I am pretty sure that if the election were held tomorrow, Donald Trump would win it. And the polls on the swing states, although obviously in many cases less reliable than the national polls, are dismal in the southern tier, Georgia, Arizona, Nevada. There's been a swing of more than 10 points against Biden in Nevada, and I suspect that reflects his weakness among Hispanic voters in heavily Hispanic Nevada. The northern tier, Wisconsin, is within reach. He's leading in Pennsylvania, but Michigan is a real trouble spot. And it doesn't take advanced math to see that if the southern tier is in trouble for Biden, Michigan becomes the pivotal state in the election, which means that the issues that are creating difficulties for him become the pivotal issues in Michigan and nationally. So I wish I could find some good news in this poll for the fans and supporters of Joe Biden, of whom I'm one. but I can't see any right now. And they will have to be betting a lot on the ability of the campaign and events to turn things around.
So, Phil, what we hear from the campaign, and we have for a really long time, because the polls have been consistently bad since the summer, is people aren't paying attention. Oh my gosh, Donald Trump is a disaster. It's going to be great. We have so much money. We're going to start our ad campaign. So there are things that Bill wrote about in the Wall Street Journal that could turn things around, right? Events like, well, first of all, people were promised a recession and they're not getting one. Perhaps there are rates that go down and make people feel better towards September. Joe Biden gets a ceasefire, maybe even gets closer to some kind of a two-state solution, which is not only just stopping the bleeding literally, but maybe even looks like a win, whatever. Things that could happen that could make it better. But just in terms of the power of persuasion, that is what they keep telling us, that they just are getting started. Do you believe in 2024, given the headwinds against him, on real substantive issues, that the power of advertising and surrogates and messaging is going to, I know they're well-resourced, but do you think they can turn it around?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're talking about polling. I mean, this is a standard response to these sorts of things. We're talking about polling 8 months in advance, right?
Right.
Sure, fine, great, right? You know, I mean, I saw a thing the other day that reminded me that you know, John McCain was leading in the summer of 2008. Things turn around, things change, right? There are a lot of ways in which one can look at the crosstabs of polls and if you are a Biden supporter, become particularly alarmed. I understand that. This was always going to be a close race. I think it's still going to be a close race. We will see the extent to which those numbers change over time. If that poll were to come out on October 15th, yeah, I feel like if I'm Joe Biden, then I'm panicking. All of that said, to answer your question, yes, I do think it is true that a lot of Americans are not really paying attention. I think the better question is, will they be paying more attention by November? Or are they simply saying, here we go again, it's the same two guys, I used to like Biden, I don't like him at all anymore, I'm just not going to show up. I think that this dynamic of Biden's popularity dropping, particularly among Black voters, particularly among younger voters, I think that's really central to what's going to happen over the course of the year. And I think one of the things that is under-recognized is that Biden's push in part on this democracy argument, which obviously is a very valid argument, the concerns about Donald Trump, you know, coming back into office have real validity when we're talking about the sanctity of democracy. It is also an argument, though, that takes the focus away from Biden. And it makes it a Trump-focused election. We're already seeing polls that show that people who support Biden, most of them are voting as a response to Donald Trump, which was the same thing that happened in 2020 and helped Biden win. But I think the democracy argument in part targets that. If you are a young person, you are an independent, you're not tightly associated with the Democratic Party, you don't really care about the party, but you recognize that the party shares your values more, but then you're focusing on Joe Biden, you really don't like Joe Biden, he's too old, you don't like him, yada, yada, yada. You may, however, be compelled by this democracy argument. You may be compelled by this other issue that is out there. And I think that's the sort of thing that over the course of the next 8 months, the Biden campaign is really going to focus on. Look, you may not like me. You may not think I've done a great job. Of course, I'm not going to say that, but you get the point. You may not like me, but at the end of the day, here's why this election is important. And that may be the thing that then compels people to come out. And of course, when we talk about African-American voters, when we talk about young voters, turnout is really the key. And if you can make that compelling argument, get people to turn out, then suddenly the ballgame changes.
All right. So, Linda, we're going to get back to that Americans focusing on the democracy dictator question in a minute. But I want to ask you about abortion and IVF. This is another thing that the Biden campaign has been saying for a long time, since the 2022 midterm, since the Dobbs v. Jackson decision, that this is it. This is it. It's kryptonite. This is it. Republicans can't come back from this. They have no answer on it. How potent do you think, literally, if you talk to Democrats about this panic, about these polls, they go, Trump's so bad, and abortion. It's sort of like that's their default. What do you think about the salience of that? It has driven a lot of turnout. It has energized a lot of engagement, money, voter registration, mobilization. I mean, there's no question that it is delivered. What do you think about it in a general electorate, which is different in a presidential year?
Well, first of all, I think abortion issue itself is going to be on the ballot in a number of key states, including, I believe, Arizona. There are a whole list of them where there are going to be ballot initiatives to try to protect abortion rights in certain states. And that, I think, will be very helpful, particularly with young women but also young men. I think that the whole problem, not the whole problem, but at least a part of the problem, as Bill suggested, is turnout and whether or not young voters are going to actually go to the polls and show up and vote as they did last time. If they don't, the election is lost. And the same is true of Black voters and others. So if abortion is on the ballot in key states, I think it will drive voter turnout. And I think that will be helpful. But I have to tell you, I am more pessimistic this week than I have, I think, ever been during about this election. You know, the problem is, as much as Joe Biden would like to talk about how good the economy is, et cetera, how much he's done, how much he's accomplished, even in the face of a do-nothing Congress, unless people feel it in their own lives, and they should be feeling it. I mean, real wages have gone up, and they've gone up more for people at the low-income sectors. But if they don't feel it, if they don't have this sense that America's on the upswing, I think it's very difficult to persuade them of that. And so then you have to give them some alternative. And while I absolutely agree with Philip that certainly to people around this table, the whole question of democracy and the future of our republic is certainly enough motivator for someone like me who is not really in agreement with Joe Biden on a lot of his issues, to get out there and vote again for him because the alternative is so unacceptable. But I worry and I am pessimistic. Maybe it's because I spend too much time reading Russian novels, but I just finished reading for the second time The Brothers Karamazov. And the very famous chapter in that book called The Grand Inquisitor is an argument between Christ, who comes back to earth, and the Grand Inquisitor. And in that argument, Christ loses, and he loses because the Grand Inquisitor understands that people don't necessarily want freedom. This idea that we all want freedom, I'm not so sure that that's actually true, that there are a great many of people who simply want stability and predictability, and they feel like their lives were more stable, they feel like there was less crime, that the economy was doing better. Until the pandemic hit under Donald Trump than they do today. Now, I think that's irrational. I don't think it's right. But if that is why we're seeing these kinds of polls, and, you know, I hate to throw in an anecdotal report on this because Bill, you know, has given us all this great data and Philip, of course, does it every week. But, you know, I rode in an Uber this week on my way to the airport with a Black Uber driver. A very talkative fellow who wanted to tell me the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And he talked about crime. He talked about what's happening in the schools and how he's going to have to take his kids out of public school because he can't stand what's happening there. And I started bringing up gingerly, you know, Trump. And yeah, I didn't really say very much when I brought up Trump. But when I mentioned Biden, he said, well, you can't support Biden, can you? And I thought, oh, my goodness. If, you know, I mean, if he is in any way emblematic of a guy in his late 50s or early 60s who has an entrepreneurial spirit, and he is entertaining, clearly, the idea of voting for Trump, then we are in real trouble.
I think that's clear from the polling that Biden is going to depend on older African-American voters who still approve of him, but his hemorrhaging of support with younger Black voters, it's real because it's in every poll. Mm-hmm. Now, we are going to return, as I promised, to this question about democracy in a second. But let's talk about Nikki Haley. She's out of the race. I think she's a phony, and I don't trust her 2 inches in front of me. She ran what I think was an incredibly disciplined and effective campaign for a year, and I will give her that. She is leaving us guessing on what she's going to do. You have a great piece out about how her campaign was fueled by the fading fumes of Reaganism, and you want her to burn the GOP to the ground. Take the floor.
Well, this is not an example of a a post or a column written from the position of hard-nosed realism about what will happen. I think this is extremely unlikely, but I thought it was useful not only for my own sense of catharsis to write such a post, but to kind of think through the dynamics between the parties at this moment. I really have to say, after 8 years, I am very tired of people who are Republicans in that old school sense, of people who strongly supported Reagan, the first Bush, the second Bush, then the campaigns of John McCain and Mitt Romney, who are still, after 8 years of this circus under Trump, trying to hold on to some tiny outcropping of rock from which they fantasize they will get their chance again. There will be a restoration. Nikki Haley, no, oh no, not 2024, but 4 years from now, I'll be back. Trump will lose, and then I'll have my chance, and we'll be back to 2004 again. I think this is delusional, and ironically, Haley's campaign has definitively shown that this is a delusion at this point. Nikki Haley did run a very powerful campaign. She bested all the competition, came out on top as the alternative to Trump, and then stayed in the race with considerable resources for a long time. And what did we learn? She won about a quarter of Republican votes in many places. But in the South, she won somewhere between 14 to 20% of the votes of Republican voters. And then also did very badly in California and Alaska and other places. This is not the future of the Republican Party. This is the past of the Republican Party. And I would love it if Nikki Haley would stop being cautious and self-absorbed and self-regarding. And instead of trying to somehow maneuver things so she can stay and play for the future, if she would just say, look, I don't love Joe Biden. I've never voted for the Democrats, but this is a special situation. And the people in the party who voted for me, millions of them, should, for the moment, vote for the Democratic Party, because this Republican Party is a threat to the United States and through that, the world, and it must burn. And so we're going to do that. And you know, when we move over to the Democratic Party, we will get some leverage because that's a lot of people. And it will change the dynamic in lots of local races and state races to have us now tilting to the center left. And just as the Reagan Revolution had the effect of sort of forcing the Democrats to hew to the center left for a generation with Bill Clinton, then even with Barack Obama and with Biden, I think that those forces will be strengthened if those voters actually move across the aisle. You know, not promising to do it forever, but to do it for this election, and then we'll see. How does the Democratic Electoral Coalition shift when you have this tilt over to the Democrats? That's the only path where I actually see what could be a more positive future for the other party, the right-leaning party, whether it's a burning of the current GOP and it being reconstituted under the same name later after it loses, say, with 40% of the vote, with all those Haley voters leaving, or it simply comes to an end like the old Whig Party, and then we get another center-right party in its place. Maybe Haley could have, you know, a hope for leadership in such a vehicle later. But thinking that this Republican Party that elected that guy, Mark Robinson, I guess his name is, the would-be Republican governor of North Carolina, the 140-odd Republicans who voted not to certify Biden's victory in 2020, the party that's supporting Carrie Lake in Arizona after she lost the governor's race there the last time, supporting her for the Senate. That Republican Party is going to be the future for Nikki Haley? No, that's not going to happen. And I would like to see that faction stop pretending that it will, and it might have a good effect.
The 2028 thing is so hilarious. Just as you note, if Biden wins, it's still Trump's party. She's not going to be, all of a sudden they're going to say, Trump, we've had it with you. We've lost too many elections with you. We're going to go with Nikki Haley. And then, of course, if Trump wins, we're never going to have another free and fair election anyway. There's no 2028 for her. He's not retiring. He's not leaving. So that's crazy. Phil, with regard to Republicans for Biden, we cannot count on these electeds because they are all, but for Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and Mitt Romney, they're unwilling to throw their careers away. So he has no strength without their weakness, but he has so much of their weakness, so he has so much strength. And looking at Chris Christie and Nikki Haley and Asa Hutchinson and how this sort of shakes out, what do you see? Because I look at Christie and I think he wants to be relevant, right? So he's going to come around and he's going to endorse Joe Biden, just like Liz Cheney is going to. She's telegraphed that she's going to, because he wants to be in the mix. I don't think he's going to just go home quietly. And he's not pretending he's the future of a Republican Party like Damon described. So what do you think Nikki Haley will do? What do you think this kind of weakness in Trump's turnout does? The thing I always go back to is in 2022, more Republicans turned out and voted than Democrats. Just a lot of them voted for Democrats. So they're there. They need people to come out and say something. And I see Asa squirming around and Nikki being mysterious. And what's your sense of sort of how much Biden can pull in some public statements from Republicans, even if they don't endorse him, saying, I'm just not going to vote for Trump? What's your vibe?
Okay, so I think it's unlikely. So I'm gonna be a bit of a contrarian here. I don't think Nikki Haley ran a good campaign. I don't. I went to New Hampshire. She, you know, that was her make or break moment. She had nothing on the ground. She wasn't doing anything. She got lucky. She stuck in the race, even though she'd already lost. And as a result of sticking in the race, she got a lot of people who wanted to send a message to Donald Trump to come out and vote, right? In two of the three places where he had exit polls on Tuesday, most of her vote came from people who weren't Republicans. It was independents and Democrats crossing party lines to come out and send this message. And so that also is why I don't think Donald Trump is as weak as people are portraying it, because those people were never going to vote for Donald Trump. They came out to try and block Donald Trump. They're not going to vote for him in November, right? They were never going to do that. They weren't like, oh, I'm trying to decide between the two. They were trying to send a message. Right. And so I don't think that weakness exists. And I think when we look at, you know, I mean, to go back to the cab driver, right, I think that's a good example of a worldview that's out there, that you are choosing between two people. And there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who, yes, understand that Donald Trump is erratic, maybe even find him dangerous, but also understand that on a day-to-day basis, what the president does is potentially sign into law legislation and appoint people to the Supreme Court and appoint, you know, judges to the bench. And that is the thing that they're looking at. And so I don't think there are a lot of Republicans who are going to come out and say, yes, I support Joe Biden because Donald Trump's dangerous. They're going to either say nothing or they're going to come out and endorse Trump because they want those judges and they want that legislation signed. And I think that is fair. Right. It is fair to view the presidency, particularly if you are skeptical that this long tail event of Donald Trump disrupting American democracy to a significant extent will actually occur, which I also think, you know, it is a long tail risk. It's not like if he's elected, immediately American democracy is going to collapse. Like, we all understand that. If you are willing to take that bet and figure we can get by for another 4 years and get some more, you know, maybe get a 7-2 majority on the Supreme Court and get more judges, like, that's the bet that's being made. I don't know that what Chris Christie's going to do. Chris Christie does like attention, but he's also been quiet at times, right? So maybe he'll come out for Biden. I don't think it makes any difference. You know, I don't think there are a whole lot of people who are waiting. You know, I mean, we saw that in the Republican primary. People, if Republicans cared what Chris Christie was going to say, they were going to vote for him for president. They didn't. And they didn't in 2016 either, right? So, yeah, I mean, this is going to be a close election. And there may be things that happen at the edges which are significant, turnout being one of them, people crossing lines being another. But to go back to this New York Times Siena College poll, Trump had more support from his party than Joe Biden did. I mean, it's within a margin of error. It's, you know, a percentage point or two. But it is not the case that Trump is uniquely disadvantaged by dissatisfaction with his party in a way that Biden isn't. And as such, I think there is, to an extent, a lot of this focus on Haley and so on and so forth is just trying to figure out a scenario in which one can view the election as being more favorable to Biden than is probably warranted.
Okay, Bill, I want to know if you agree with Phil. What is your assessment from the results of Trump's weakness? I would like to believe that there are reluctant Trump voters who still can be shamed. What are your thoughts?
I know that there's an old maxim to the effect that the wish is the father to the thought. And I'm afraid that that mental dynamic is at work here. I have to say, I agree with Philip completely. And let me just put another New York Times finding on the table. Trump voters in 2020 and Biden voters in 2020. Of the people who voted for Trump in 2020, 97% say that they're going to be voting for Trump again, and 0% say that they're going to be voting for Joe Biden. Shift over to Biden, 83% of 2020 Biden voters said I'm going to vote for him again, and 10%, you know, 10%, which is a meaningful number, say they're going to support Trump instead. So I think that you know, Phillip's bottom line, namely that there, you know, not only are there no particular signs of weakness in the Republican coalition, but in fact, there are more signs of weakness in the Democratic coalition, or at least the people who voted for Biden in 2020, I think is absolutely correct. Now, there is one caveat here, and this goes to Phillip's point about what can happen in the next 8 months. There is a pretty consistent strand of polling to the effect that if Donald Trump were to be convicted of a serious crime, that would move enough people at the margin to make a difference, potentially enough to make a difference in the outcome of the election. That's not a trivial event. It wouldn't be if it occurred. You know, and a number of analysts have pointed out that Americans distinguish, as they should, between an indictment and a conviction. You know, and if a jury finds you guilty of something serious, that's something that people who are not totally in the tank for Trump have to take seriously.
Okay, Linda, I do not believe that we will have any trial beyond Alvin Bragg's trial starting on March 25th. It will not be considered by a majority of this electorate choosing Trump in general election matchups a serious conviction, should he get it. We don't know if he will. I just don't think it's going to bum them out. It's not a serious crime. Republicans will tell them, as they did before, it's a bookkeeping error. And so where does that leave us? Because I want to believe that there are two-time Trump voters who turned on him after January 6th. There will not be a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And I know that Biden has lost. I know Trump has new converts, new Latino, Black, and young converts. And that these voters who are not politically addicted are making their choices as Phil describes, especially the Republican ones. Well, I just need this regulation I opposed, and I just need this judge. I understand that. But I do believe, because I know anecdotally, that there are two-time Trump voters who will not support him. Do you think that he's weak and that these primary contests bore that out? Do you agree with Bill and Phil that actually, no, he's unified the party and Biden is the only one with weaknesses?
I would like to think that there are those two-time Trump voters who are going to switch and suddenly vote for Biden. But I think the number of people who are going to do that is probably so minuscule that it's not likely to have an effect. And by the way, it would have to have an effect in those battleground states, because that's where the election is won and lost. So they'd have to be in Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, et cetera. So if they're not there and there are not is not a critical mass of them, that's not going to do it. I know this is going to sound like I'm grasping at straws, and I am. I'm grasping at straws, but I do see a mental deterioration in Donald Trump that is pretty striking. And I'm not just talking about his constantly referring to President Obama instead of President Biden, which he's done so many times now that he has decided that he should say that it's intentional and that they're indistinguishable because, of course, he's, you know, doing the
branding,
the dog whistle there, right? and, you know, he might get away with it with his true believers. But he's not only made those kinds of mistakes. There was a speech he gave in the last couple of weeks. I'm a little blurred on when it was because I was overseas and I was watching things mostly in snippets. But he gave a speech in which he actually exhibited, I think, what would be clinically termed aphasia. It wasn't that he couldn't remember the word or got the wrong word or, you know, a malapropism. He tried to say Venezuela, couldn't get it out, and he literally babbled. He made incomprehensible noises into the microphone and then went on. But, you know, I'm looking at that and, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, obviously, although I live in a family of a lot of doctors. And I thought there's something really wrong here. And clearly the stress is building. And I see that stress of the trial, the Alvin Bragg trial, is more significant than the testimony or anything that develops in this trial. I think the stress on Trump, just as the stress on him from these really gargantuan fines that have been leveled against him in both his financial against the company and for misstating on its financial forms, the actual value of his properties, et cetera, and in the E. Jean Carroll verdict, where he's having to scramble for money. I mean, he called Elon Musk in, was hoping maybe Musk will help bail him out, at least pour enough money, which Musk now says he's not going to do in giving to the candidate, but he didn't preclude giving money to a super PAC, et cetera. But this is really getting to Donald Trump, and it gets him where it matters, in his pocketbook and in his definition of himself. So that's my grasping at straws. I wish I could offer something more encouraging with lots of data behind it, like Bill would, but I can't come up with anything.
I think him slurring his words is significant. And if it happens again, it's going to be a real problem because the Democrats are certainly up to using social media to spread that around.
One thing that can definitely interfere with a good night's sleep is feeling too hot or too cold. I have to say, Miracle Made sheets help with this. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics to make temperature regulating much easier. You sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. The self-cooling properties are the key. This silver-infused fabric, which was inspired by NASA, makes the sheets thermoregulating, so you sleep comfortably and wake up feeling refreshed. Miracle sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands and feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some five-star hotels. So go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, you can save 40%. If you use your promo code BEGTODIFFER at checkout, you'll also get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer and use the code BEGTODIFFER to claim your towel set, 3 free pieces, and save over 20%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to treat yourself or someone else. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
So now let's talk about this question of whether or not the democracy issue, the threat of Trump as dictator, the promise he's made, Project 2025, he is an authoritarian, he wants to centralize power, he doesn't want to be checked by a Congress or courts or the Constitution. The New York Times writes yesterday or whenever, does the public have collective amnesia about Trump or did they just dig it? It's fine. So we're all grappling with that question, right? How informed are people about things like his handling of COVID or his role in January 6th and whether or not he was staging a coup for 2 months beforehand? So the New Republic writes the piece about the new polling that Jeff Garin did about how once presented, a lot of voters don't know about any of this threat to the actual system. They think they live in democracy. It's all over them every day. And they don't think that they will lose it. And they don't understand what separation from it would feel like or look like. And that when presented with these specific threats, the voters, their view of Trump changed and his unfavorables went up. So that's an opening for the Biden campaign. So I want all of you to weigh in on this. Do you have to talk about the kitchen table? And when you talk about Trump, you just make the voters more mad because he's priced in. What are your thoughts? And let's go down to Damon.
Well, you know, I was a bit of a skeptic in 2020 about the decision of the campaign to emphasize the democracy argument as much as it did. And this was, of course, before January 6th.
Of course.
And you know, given that Biden won and the popular vote, he did it by 7 million votes. And so it seems in retrospect like that was definitely the right call. I know the Biden people like to credit the decision of Biden and his people in the midterms to really emphasize the democracy argument as the big reason why there was no red wave. You know, of course, also Dobbs, they note that too. So, you know, based on that history, I guess I should sort of sit back and be like, all right, Biden people, if that's how you think you're going to win, maybe you're right. Go ahead and do that. My instincts, I will confess, are that I think there are limits to how much good it will do, for the simple fact that I suspect, you know, if you could sit down with an ostensibly neutral pollster with one-to-one with voters across the whole country and explain the way democracy works and the process of certifying votes and what Trump did and who he spoke to and the manipulation and what he wanted Pence to do and what John Eastman was saying and laid all of that out one-to-one with each voter. Do I think it could have a meaningful effect? Yeah, probably. You probably could get a whole bunch of people to say, you know, I didn't realize Trump really is dangerous. But that obviously isn't the way it's going to be. And I think for low information voters, we're dealing with what you might call what if 9/11 never happened problem. So like, remember, George W. Bush received intelligence that there might be something going on, a potential terrorist attack, a really big one by Al-Qaeda. And he didn't act on it. Of course, there was intelligence noise. There are always threats of things swirling around. And so people ask, like, well, God, what if you listen to that? And what if they, like, found the flight school and arrested Mohammed Atta and everybody and the other major hijackers, and we never get 9/11? What would have been the political consequence of that? I would say nothing. It would have been like a blip in the news that nobody paid attention to, because 9/11 is only this terrible thing we wish never happened because it happened. And so I think a lot of low information voters hear the Democrats going on and on about the danger of Trump. And maybe in 2020, you know, in the swirl of the chaos of the Trump administration and COVID and everything and all the investigations, people were sort of receptive to this. And then ironically, even though we had January 6th, which was so much worse than anything that had happened before, most voters are probably like, yeah, whatever. Like, you know, Biden became president and he's president and nothing terrible happened. In fact, I felt richer then and I got all these great checks with Donald Trump's signature on them. And like, and so they sort of, I fear a kind of Chicken Little problem of people saying like, yeah, you're always saying that it's going to be so terrible. But he was president for 4 years, and what terrible thing happened? Actually, my life was a little better then, and so I'm inclined to say, yeah, stop saying that. That's what I worry about, the kind of, it just being a little, like, not sufficiently salient to change these underlying trends that we've been talking about on the show up till now. But then again, I am Damon Downer, and that's my brand.
Hey, so, man. Yeah.
Take it for what it's worth.
Yeah, I'm your grim twin. Okay. So, Phil, we do know in 2022 that these Republicans who went to the polls and voted for, like, popular governors, obviously, in Texas and New Hampshire and Georgia and Ohio, in swing states, voted down election deniers, specifically all of them, Secretary of State, gubernatorial candidates. They discerned this issue was salient. So where do you come down on whether or not, I mean, how the Biden can use it, abuse it, overuse it? The polling, the Jeff Garen polling thing is interesting. And Damon is right. We can't sit everybody down and like do like, you know, how a bill becomes a law with them. But is there a way to, I know they're going to start talking about it, right? We were told that the Biden administration is going to try to like market Project 2025. Do you think that this will make a difference?
Yeah. Two things I'd say. The first is that the central question is that communication, right? Damon used the expression low information voters. I think it's more accurate to say bad information voters, right?
Right.
That there are people who listen to Fox News and are immersed in right-wing social media and just get bad information, get lies all the time, get dishonest representations of what's going on in the world. They believe that crime is soaring. They believe that all these various things happened, right? And it's just not true. But it is presented over and over on Fox News, presented over and over in Donald Trump Jr.'s Twitter feed and whatever it happens to be that these things are going on. That's the impermeability that I think is the challenge, right? So even if you had a pollster sit down, and we see this on Fox News, Bernie Sanders, there's this very, very striking example. Bernie Sanders sat down with Fox News, I think it was in 2020, it might have been even after that, and had this town hall meeting with him for an hour. And then the next 2 hours straight were them picking apart what Bernie Sanders had said. And so he'd like, he went on the show and had this conversation, and then Fox News just ripped it apart, because that's what they do, right? So this is the universe in which Biden is trying to make traction. I wrote a piece after he won that his main opponent, the right-wing media universe, was still undefeated, that he had beaten Trump, but there was still this thing that he had not managed to conquer. The other thing that I'll say is that Biden is different than a Secretary of State in a state, right? No one knows who the Secretary of State is. No one cares who their Secretary of State is until it's election day and they do a little Googling and they say, oh, you know, that's different than the presidency. People have views of Biden and Trump. Informed well, poorly informed, it doesn't matter. They have a view. They understand it, right? And so you're already working against an understanding of who Joe Biden is. Joe Biden doesn't just have to come out and say, hey, I'm Joe Biden. You never heard of me, and here's what I stand for. He's got to come out and say, hey, I know you don't like me, and maybe you like this other guy who I'm also running against and who you also have preconceived notions of, and here's my presentation of why he'd be bad and I'd be good within this universe where Donald Trump is robustly bolstered by all this chatter that is just nonsense and misinformation, right? So, yes, I am sure, to Damon's point and to the point of that poll, that if you tell people, here are the things that happened and here are the concerns that actual experts have about what might happen should Donald Trump be reinaugurated in 2025, that people say, oh, those sound bad, right? The challenge is, not only would you have to sit down with everyone with that pollster, you'd also have to do it 2 seconds before they vote. Because otherwise, they're just re-immersed in the bad information universe, and then things go sideways again very quickly.
Oh, so true. Bill, what do you think?
I have a slightly different view. I note two things. Number one, the threat is real. It's not made up. And it is easy to show, you know, based on publicly released plans for 2025, that the think tanks and the senior aides that have rallied behind Trump, I've been thinking very carefully, for example, about the use of the Insurrection Act, you know, which is a perfectly legal vehicle for what in effect is the declaration of martial law in the United States. And there are various other things that can be documented. The second point is that Joe Biden believes it, right? And so this argument passes the authenticity test, right? He can be passionate about this. And the same way that he was passionate in 2020 about, you know, the conflict between democracy and autocracy being the major issue in the world. I think it's always better when a candidate says what he passionately believes to be the case, right? Because I think it was you who used the word phony about Nikki Haley. I mean, if people can smell phony arguments, they can smell purely political arguments that are ginned up, you know, for political purposes. The third point is this. Joe Biden, in my judgment, is not going to win the economic argument. And I have all sorts of reasons for believing that, but that would take us too far afield. And my information, for what it's worth, is that he's going to punt on immigration tonight. That is to say that he is not going to announce a bold step. That he is going, in effect, to say the Republicans should have passed the the tripartisan bill that was worked out in the Senate. He's going to call on them to do that, which the House won't. And then he's going to lay out the elements of his own preferred program. I'm afraid that the reaction to that is going to be very negative, because there are a bunch of Democrats who believe that he ought to announce a temporary border closure and should already have announced it. And he will be seen as having flinched in the face of pressure from the advocates, including the advocacy groups in his own administration. So what's he going to campaign on? I've just ticked off the two top issues in the minds of the American people. I don't think he has any choice but to emphasize democracy and abortion / IVF, because I don't think he's in a particularly strong position to engage on the other arguments that are top of mind for the American people.
Linda, what do you think? I think it's been effective, but I understand why voters tune it out. Campaign consultants say it's not going to work. You got to talk to them about the price of eggs. What do you think they should do?
Well, I think actually that there has to be a combination. I actually think the democracy issue is a winning issue, but it has to be presented as a kitchen table kind of discussion. And that's where abortion works, because you have all of these people, including a couple that were forced to leave the state of Texas in order to have an abortion, a pregnancy that was going to fail and that endangered the mother, and in which the baby, if it were actually born alive, would live a maximum of a week. When you can make those stories real and you can try to get people to understand that this isn't a theoretical discussion. This isn't, you know, going back to Philadelphia and discussing the difference between democracy and republic and representative government and two houses of Congress. It's not the kind of academic, very abstract kind of discussion. This is something that affects your life, and abortion does that. I would disagree a bit with Bill on immigration. He and I have disagreed. We've sort of reversed roles. Bill is to my right. I'm on the left on this issue on the podcast. But I would talk about immigration. First of all, I think talking about the way the Republicans killed what was necessary in order to give Joe Biden the tools to be able to act more forcefully. But there's another issue, and that leads us to this Project 25. Americans are worried about those people flooding in, but throughout America, whether you're talking about, you know, even red states, places like Iowa, immigrants have revitalized rural America. They buy homes, they buy cars, they start businesses, and people have in their community people whom they know. They may go to church, evangelicals, very, very strong presence of evangelical Hispanics in various parts of the country, particularly in rural areas. If you can dramatize what Donald Trump wants to do, it isn't just that he wants to stop people from coming in. He wants to take people who've been here 20 years, established lives here, own their homes, started a business, are actually employing other people. He wants to round them up. He wants to put them in tents in the desert, and he wants to, with absolutely no due process at all, ship them back to the country he thinks they ought to be living in. And sometimes that's going to involve people who are not even here illegally, because that's what's happened every time we've had those kind of mass roundups. People who are either legal residents or were born in the United States, but may not have, you know, their birth certificate. I don't carry mine or my passport with me most days. They're going to end up in these camps. I think if you can dramatize that and get home the message that these are your neighbors, these are the people whose restaurants you go to, these are the people who you sell cars to, etc., and understand that somebody who is going to take dictatorial power to do something that is not within the law in order to get rid of these people, I think that kind of message could play. And I think it's going to take Hollywood to do it. And by the way, the last time I checked, Hollywood was very much in the Democratic side of the ledger. And I believe that they could come up with some very, very effective ads on abortion and even on the immigration issue that could be effective.
Okay, it's time for our low light or highlight of the week, and I'm going to start with Bill.
Well, it won't surprise the faithful listeners of Beg to Differ that I have yet another low light, and it won't surprise them either that it involves the Russian invasion of Ukraine. While we dither about renewing aid to Ukraine, it is literally the case that Ukraine is running out of the ammunition that it needs to hold the lines that it has held at such extraordinary human price for the past year. The Russians are moving forward in a number of areas where they are outgunning the Ukrainians 10 to 1 in artillery shells, where Ukrainian soldiers have been told to save their ammunition from their guns and their, you know, and their rifles and their machine guns for large groups of Russians. And if you see one or two Russians moving forward, don't waste your bullet. You know, it makes me want to howl and it makes me want to cry, right? These are people who are prepared to surrender their lives in defense of freedom and independence and democratic self-government. They're not asking us to shed a drop of blood. All they're asking us for is the tools to do the job. And we're not giving them to them? Shame on us and shame on the Speaker of the House.
Amen. Damon.
Well, here's going to be a case where I'm going to give you a highlight, and I suspect it's a highlight that a plurality or majority of our listeners will consider a low light. But hey, it's all called Beg to Differ, isn't it? This week, it's really amazing what a big news week it was for politics that we had this really huge Supreme Court decision on Monday, and it hasn't even come up. The Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that we cannot disqualify Donald Trump for presidency using the third section of the 14th Amendment. And I have to say, thank goodness. I have been deeply ambivalent all along about the kind of lawfare approach to trying to save us from Donald Trump, making the case over and over again that he is a political problem who must be defeated politically. And if he cannot be defeated politically, then woe betide the United States. But this particular gambit of using the 14th Amendment to kind of rid us of Trump, I have found from the moment it was put forth, I've thought it was completely indefensible and just unpersuasive. And I hoped and prayed and suspected that the Supreme Court would agree with me. And the fact that John Roberts was able to get all nine justices on board with at least the per curiam portion of the decision, I think, is very good. I very much support it. And I say ixnay to all of the naysayers out there who kind of were rending their garments about this in a display of pique this week. I was pleased by it. And I think it is, even if it means we get Donald Trump reelected, I think that is better than trying to remove him from the political scene by summarily declaring him invalid as a candidate. And obviously, that's a big thing we could debate for a long time. We're not going to do it. But that's where I come down, at least.
Phil.
So the real highlight of my week was my 7-year-old coming home from school with this assignment saying that, you know, explaining what he's going to be like when he's 100 years old and saying that he wants to be a surfer in California with blue hair that wears sunglasses. That was the actual highlight of my week. From a work perspective, the highlight of my past 7 days, to use week more loosely, has been the second collapse of the House impeachment probe, right? The first collapse was obviously people probably know this by now, that the supposed informant who alleged that Biden and Hunter Biden had taken a bribe was revealed to have made the whole thing up and indicted by the Department of Justice. The secondary collapse was the interview with Hunter Biden that occurred last week. The transcript for it came out and made very obvious that not only was there no real case, but that Hunter Biden was very deftly able to sort of brush things away. And it's sort of fascinating now to watch Republicans particularly James Comer, the head of the Oversight Committee, trying to scramble and figure out how they're going to resuscitate this thing that there's so much demand for. Even just last night, he's on Hannity and, you know, trying to really pump the machine here and trying to get people engaged in this idea that something wrong happened. And he just keeps tripping over his own toes just because he has nothing to work with, and he never has. And so I think it is good. There is now more evidence that this whole thing, which was obviously contrived from the outset, was in fact contrived, and that it is making Republicans have to deal with the embarrassing scenario of their having gotten way out over their skis on this thing.
It's going to be an interesting part of the next 8 months, which are so dreadful, to watch them not be able to have a vote on the House floor because they don't have the goods and they have to sort of keep the investigation going, but they don't really know why or how. Linda, how about you?
Well, you know, this show is called Beg to Differ. And if a listener is hearing the show for the first time today, they're going to have a very confused picture of which of us is left of center and which of us is right of center, because I beg to differ strongly with my friend Damon Linker on this week's Supreme Court decision. That was my real low light of the week. I am a textualist and an originalist. I believe the text, the words matter in what they say. I believe the history matters. And I think Donald Trump is and would be Jefferson Davis if he could. And in fact, he tried to lead an army into the Capitol to take over. I think it was his bone spurs that prevented him from marching up the avenue to lead that attack. But I think that was a low light, and it was further exemplified in an article I'm going to recommend to our listeners, The Fallout of Trump's Colorado Victory by John Hendrickson, that appeared in The Atlantic. And it's all about the Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold, who, you know, was sort of front and center on that, even though I think she was a defendant in the suit, because it was, you know, she was the one who was going to have to put the name on the ballot or not. And this was an article about how Jenna Griswold's life has changed. And it was shocking. The kinds of abuse that she has had to put up with. I will read you an edited version of one of the calls that she received, hoping that some effing immigrant from effing Iran cuts the heads of her kids off and that somebody shoots her in the head. That was one of the milder of the kinds of things she had to put up with, just for being somebody who had to ultimately make the decision, keep Donald Trump on the ballot or not. And I think this shows what terrible state our democracy is in. When people who do the ordinary jobs of going to the polls on election night and helping count the ballots end up like Shay Moss and her mother, Miss Ruby, Lady Ruby, end up having their lives turned upside down. This to me is really one of the scariest things that we've seen. I don't recall a time in all of my political life when I have seen this kind of animus directed, this kind of violent rhetoric directed to people that disagree on a particular candidate. And I think that's my low light for the week.
And no doubt Nikki Haley will be considering, when she decides what to say about Donald Trump, how much she's going to spend out of her personal finances on security per day. For Mitt Romney, it's $5,000. Mitch McConnell can afford it, but he still endorsed Trump. It is literally now.
And that was my other low. I forgot. I'm glad you mentioned that. I was hoping against hope that the reason that he was stepping aside from his minority leadership position was so that he could not endorse. I got proved wrong on that.
I was grasping with you, Linda, on that. Well, my low light is my favorite exit poll finding from Nikki Haley's final night on Super Tuesday of North Carolina Republican voters. Does Nikki Haley have the physical and mental health needed to serve as president? 58% yes, 39% no. Does Trump? Yes, 76%. No, 22%. And anyone on Twitter this week has seen some very interesting misogynistic interviews about whether or not Nikki Haley or a woman could serve. The only one I can repeat is the woman in the diner who openly told the Fox interviewer that she was concerned about Nikki Haley being in menopause. So I just want to emphasize that the cruelty is the point, but the misogyny is also one of the baked in points of MAGA that is truly still in 2024, just staggering to me. I loved this conversation. Thank you all for joining me. It was a delight to fill in for Mona. She will be back next week. Thank you all for joining us.